Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the post-Oscars morning edition.
Oh, my goodness. I thank the Academy for this honor.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
And ladies, don't let anybody tell you you are ever past your prime.
Everything, everywhere.
It's intimidating speaking up here, let me just tell you that.
I just want an Oscar.
Now the party and celebration continue here at the Vanity Fair Oscar party.
Is that Rihanna?
Oh my God, it's Kate Hudson. I love her so much.
And I kept having to pause the hairdryer because I was like, shut up, I need to hear the feet.
Where's Alice Howard? Come on down. Wow. How are you?
I'm so hungry.
Yes. Yep. You need an in and out for her.
That's classy. I don't know if we're allowed to curse, but
yes, as can be.
You get the idea. We'll be done soon. We'll see you inside.
We'll see you in there.
Burgers.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Good morning.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
As you might be able to hear, we are not in our usual locations. We're on way less sleep than we usually get because it's the morning after the Oscars. This is truly a tradition, unlike any other, where we get up way too early to talk about everything we saw the night before. It's sort of hard to know where to start. I do keep flashing back to last year where there was high drama when the Oscars were over. This year, it was dramatic in a much more enjoyable, delightful way. Honestly, I think as you know, people who've listened to this show kind of got a lot of our personal feelings about this. So I really just want to go straight to Rebecca Ford. You were so nervous about Michelle Yeoh. Rebecca, are you breathing now?
I'm so happy that moment. First of all, I'm sorry I sound like Elizabeth Banks on stage. I lost my voice at our party last night.
You and the Cocaine Bear were hanging out to her too long.
I know. To watch her have that moment after a season of not knowing if it was going to happen. And as much as we thought it was a huge risk for them to put Halle Berry up there to present, I think that made it even more special when it did actually work out. But, you know, she said what she's been saying all season, like, this is for anyone who looks like me and didn't think this was possible. And she really carried the weight of that all season. So there was no more rewarding winner for me than seeing that moment on stage.
There's a photo going around of the moment where she walks off stage with Halle Berry and Jessica Chastain with Halle's arm around Michelle and just that weight of history right there. I mean, that's what the Oscars can do. And I guess that's, you know, we'll congratulate them on that risk, even though it made us so nervous when they announced that Halle Berry and Jessica Chastain were presenting.
Yeah, I think it's totally paid off. And I feel like this is, you know, she's in the history books now. We'll talk about that moment every time we reference this category and other breakthroughs that come in the future.
Yeah. I mean, we should start from the top line. Everything Everywhere All at Once did pretty much have the night that was expected. We can get into our predictions ourselves if we want to. But David, you were in the audience there with Rebecca kind of watching it turn into a sweep in the end. It didn't feel like that at first. You guys had some Everything Everywhere All at Once, like team supporters surrounding you. That must have been a really fun energy as all those wins kept stacking up.
Oh yeah, they were sprinkled throughout the auditorium. I think I read that they were able to use extra tickets to kind of stack the audience with crew members and friends of the movie, which as they should. They had a huge night. They were expected to have a huge night, but yeah, it was kind of a rocky structure purely in terms of like getting to the feel of a sweep, because we had this weird, like, All Quiet on the Western Front interlude where if those three categories were not presented back to back to back, I don't think that would have felt quite as ominous with the bomb.
The best score, really.
What is happening right now? Is this telling me that something is happening and I need to fear for my life? But no, it was sort of bookended by just huge showings for Everything Everywhere with Kihi Kwan and Jamie Lee Curtis winning early. And then the movie just cleaning up at the end there with picture, director, actress, director, screenplay, and editing. So it did have the night that was forecast, but it did feel for a moment like it wasn't necessarily going to happen that way, even though it was pretty clear in retrospect from the outset.
Yeah, I kept the faith throughout. I kind of kept telling people I was in the room with, like, this is Dune, this is Mad Max Fury Road, you've got these technical winners that halfway through the show we started thinking, like, oh my God, is there going to be an upset? Richard, did you keep the faith too? Over you're in Austin for South by Southwest. You're a little bit out of the LA bubble. Did you have a clearer head than the rest of us?
Well, no, what's weird is I was at the party with you guys and I somehow woke up in a hotel room in Texas and I don't know how it happened.
I think you're in the multiverse now, unfortunately.
Yeah, one thing I wrote about in my review of the show was that, like, it's not the fault of All Quiet and Everything Everywhere that, like, the winners started to seem kind of repetitive. But I think that the writing was on the wall the minute that Curtis won.
Yep, I think you're right.
And Rebecca and David can speak more potently to this, but, like, there was a real applause-o-meter kind of factor happening in the audience
totally. When
they would announce nominees. And it was just like, oh, the Everything Everywhere people are just getting, like the Beatles just walked on stage every time their name is said. So it felt kind of obvious really early in the evening.
Yeah. And that's the barometer we've used all season. And it's just been the case for that movie beginning to end. The other movie that got that level of applause was Top Gun Maverick. And I kind of seemingly went out on a little bit of a limb predicting it for sound because it seemed like not a lot of people did. But I was very happy. I was very confident in that. Once I started hearing that applause, because yeah, that's the best way to gauge. It just sadly is. It can sound very simple, but.
And the applause was so tepid for movies like Tar. And I was just like, oh, I see how this is all going to go.
Yeah.
Even for Banshees a little bit, I thought. And, you know, those two big movies walked home with nothing. So.
Yeah. Let's see so Banshees, Tar, Fablemans, anything else that just.
Elvis.
Oh, Elvis. Elvis got just blanked, which is. You know, I think we knew that it was All Quiet and Elvis kind of duking it out for those technical awards, and I really thought Elvis would get some of them at least. It was almost like the movie didn't exist last night.
Yep, it didn't. I mean, it lost everything. I think it was one of the biggest losers of the night for sure, with Banshees, just in terms of nomination totals. That to me was the biggest surprise, if you could call anything from that night a surprise, because. Yeah, it just had so much representation. A lot of the craft elements are so in your face and so forward that it just seemed destined to win, especially after it won stuff at BAFTA. But I was happy that in places where it lost, you got to see a little bit of the spreading of the wealth. Like, I thought Ruth Carter was such a great win. Mm-hmm. And a really worthy win for that movie, which was not as good as the first Black Panther, which had some narrative issues, but still had these extraordinary design elements driven by these incredible artists. And after that, and, you know, really relentless Dune sweep last year, where a lot of, I think, very worthy movies like Power of the Dog just got left in the dust, it was nice to see not a total sweep below the line and different elements like a Top Gun sound or a, I don't want to say a whale makeup job because I have thoughts on that one. But
we'll get to the whale.
Even then, though, you had different kinds of movies winning, which was nice to see.
I was watching you on the live stream, Katie, a little bit, and I think you had some stat about the last time that one movie won, like, three acting prizes or something.
Yeah,
like really rare, and I think that's where we normally would see a little bit of diversity in terms of, like, what's winning, you know? Because there can be technical sweeps. That's not uncommon. But, yeah, by the time when it was like, oh, the third actor from this one movie is winning, like, it just, yeah. But when was the last time, Katie? Do you remember from what you said last night?
I think I had looked it up for this show when we were making our predictions, because that was part of why I think some of us were hesitant about the Jamie Lee Curtis surge, because it just seemed so unprecedented, because Network was the last movie to win three acting awards.
And the only other one was Streetcar, right?
Yeah, Streetcar is the only other one that's done it. So there's really a huge precedent there that says it's so hard to do. That's, you know, Everything Everywhere won 7 Oscars, which is not the biggest sweep in Oscar history, but it made it feel so massive, I think, that there was those huge awards that all went to that one movie.
But we did predict Jamie Lee Curtis. We did all our acting predictions right. So I feel real good about that.
We honestly, we divided and conquered here. We really did.
I don't even remember who we landed on. Well, I wanted to talk about supporting actress a little bit longer and Angela Bassett and Wakanda Forever, because I think if you've seen the clip of the moment that supporting actress was announced, like Angela Bassett didn't hide her disappointment, which I think is a perfectly reasonable thing to do mm-hmm. after this really relentless, exhausting season she's been through, doing kind of putting every foot right. I think you might have said it, Rebecca, like what more does she need to do to win? And the Jamie Lee Curtis win came for many valid and great reasons, but it was a sad thing to see. You wanted it to be able to go both ways, I think.
Yeah, I think I would love a case study on what happened there, because she was the front runner for so long this season, really until phase two. And you just think about how she probably felt the last time she was nominated and didn't win. Mm-hmm. And to go through that again this many years later, that was the most heartbreaking, loss for me that night. And I'm a big fan of Everything Everywhere and Jamie Lee Curtis, and that was wonderful to see her win. But you can feel both things, you know. So
yeah.
I think that was a tough one. And yeah, I think it speaks to being a front runner too early is a hard hill to climb sometimes, you know.
I like the moment just when Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors presented a little bit later. And I think Michael B. Jordan just said, like, we see you, auntie, talking about yeah. her role in Black Panther. And it reminded me of, when Olivia Colman won, she's just like, oh, my God, Glenn Close, I'm so sorry. Just seeing the person who didn't win in the front and feeling like you have to address them. That's a pretty regal position to be in.
One stat that I think I put on the live blog because someone else had sort of tipped me off to it on Twitter is that, like, A24 had an unprecedented night. I think no film studio mm-hmm. has ever won those six big awards that A24 won between Everything Everywhere and then the one for The Whale. That feels pretty significant for a relatively new company compared to old studios that has had a Best Picture winner before. But, like, I don't know. A24 just really, dominating at the Oscars. It felt very 2023 to me.
Yeah. It's also, like, so funny because if any other studio or streamer had done that well, we would have gotten, like, 12 press releases pointing it out to us. And they're just, like, quietly basking in their wins. And I just think the films they choose to support and the way they sort of present themselves as a company is a very modern take that is really, really interesting to follow.
Yeah. And they win with such an A24 movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They win with a South by premiere that is bizarre and very itself and has absolutely no awards aspirations on its face, which is, I think, part of that authentic appeal and why people did so fall in love with it, because it was very true to the spirit of that studio and those filmmakers.
Yeah, we'll get to talking about the Vanity Fair party later, but David and Rebecca, you guys saw some people from A24 at our party when the Everything Everywhere crew got there. Were they basking in a usual way, or were they really cool about it because they're A24?
I think they were so happy. I mean, I was talking to a couple of them, and I was like, well, you knew you were going to get a picture. And they were like, we don't know anything. I mean, this movie, like, it's never safe to assume, you know? So I think it felt very authentic just how happy they were for it to succeed. And especially, I think, in races like Michelle's that seemed so close right up to the end.
Yeah. Relief is the word I would use that I observed.
Before we move on from supporting categories from the early part of the night, Ki Huy Quan won the award that we all really thought he would. They did animated first, and Guillermo del Toro won. It was very widely expected, and it felt kind of placid. Like, it was just like, okay, here we go. The expected winners are winning. But then I think Ki brought a real jolt of energy really early on, as did Jamie Lee Curtis. It set a nice tone for the night. I was really grateful that the race was structured in a way to start us off with those two big wins.
Yeah, how did it play on television? Because I felt like the way the musical performances were sort of spliced in sometimes slowed the energy down in a weird way. Diane Warren's was first, and that's a slower song and one from a movie nobody saw. So it did, I don't know. I thought the pacing was a little strange during the show at times.
It was, and I think that it started, and I was like, oh, this is like pretty standard issue Oscar, which is kind of what I was hoping for. You know, it was like a nice gold set with the proper amount of stares, and Jimmy Kimmel did the jokes about the nominees that we kind of, you know, maybe there could have been a fun, like, musical number or something a little bit punchier, but like, for the most part, I was like, okay, they're just going back to basics and that's good. But then as the evening wore on, I agree, the pace got weird. It started to speed up in a way that I thought was kind of uncomfortable. They did a lot of playoffs in kind of, I thought, sort of rude fashion to try to desperately get it in under 3.5 hours or whatever. I liked that there were the pauses for the musical performances. I think the order of the performances was a little odd. I think they could have started with a more bombastic thing than the Diane Warren song is. But I appreciated the attempts to kind of return to the Oscar template of old, but like they just can't be so, I know it's an economic thing, but the worry about time really started to grate on me. I also think, and you guys almost surely didn't see this in the room, unless there's like a Jumbotron or something, but like the winners and nominees were mostly in bizarre, like really extreme close-up. Like normally it's like kind of whisked up. Yeah, during the speeches, during the presenter things too, like it felt very all of a sudden claustrophobic and you were like, just pull back a little bit, you know? So the kinks of the last few years have not been fully ironed out, even if at the beginning they really did attempt a sort of old-fashioned ceremony.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, that was, especially with the Gaga performance, something I'd heard. And there were people, always, there's always people in the bar watching on the TV. So if you were in the bar, you would be watching it that way. But yeah, the Gaga one was probably the most prominent example of people really going wild over the choices and the way it was directed and filmed.
How did it feel in the room? Because it's so stripped down.
Yeah, I mean, she held it down. I mean, after
she's Gaga, she's gonna hold everyone's attention.
I was transfixed after she finished, and it cut to commercial. She got a huge second standing ovation. It was kind of electric, honestly. I thought that one played the best in the room, seemingly versus on TV. I think there was the biggest gap there, just maybe in the way that it was broadcast.
Yeah,
but you know, I was just happy Gaga was there and doing her thing, and I was vibing with all of it.
It was like so special to be in the room for the Natu Natu performance. Like I just,
that was the best.
The energy of that performance was so fun. And it kind of made you wish there were a few more upbeat songs in the competition, but it that was a really fun performance. And then David and I ran into the performers right after, because we headed out to the bar as soon as that was done. And they were just so excited. And you just like love seeing those moments of people being like, oh my God, we just performed at the Oscars. You know, it just makes it feel really special.
I mean, shout out to the performance of This Is a Life, though, because, like, that song is also kind of downbeat. Like, Natu Natu is really the only big one in there. But it was so weird and wonderful. Like, bring back interpretive dance at the Oscars every year. I love seeing that kind of thing.
And every Best Song winner should have to sing a song as part of their speech.
Yeah.
That was wonderful.
Was he singing a riff on the Carpenter song? Or was he just talking about how he loved the Carpenters? It was really delightful.
Yeah. Between that and Cheryl Lee Ralph, more singing and acceptance speeches, we have learned, is better for all of us.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I do want to talk about the commercials that were part of the show, which I think if you were in the audience like David and Rebecca, you didn't really notice that much. But Richard, I was so mad at that Little Mermaid trailer, like probably disproportionate to the impact, because it really was people setting up a commercial break. But man, that got on my nerves.
And look, this is not exactly anything new in terms of like there are always kind of like movie promos smuggled into the Oscars, you know.
Yeah, like people present from a movie that they're starring in like in a few months.
Right. But this was a case of Disney just not being able to help themselves. You know, they were like, all right, it's on our television network. We, you know, kind of sort of resent this ceremony more and more because the ratings aren't what they used to be. So we're going to get our money's worth to have the two, you know, Melissa McCarthy and Halle Bailey, like come out as regular presenters to present a commercial or a trailer,
I guess. With a Disney logo on the screen behind them.
Yeah, that was kind of shocking, and I'll reserve what I thought about the actual look of the Little Mermaid for another episode. But the whole moment was not great. Yeah.
So because we were in the room, I may have missed it, but there was that, and then the Warner Brothers thing, which we also couldn't see in the room. Was there another one, or was it just those two?
I think that was it.
That's what feels so weird, is like, why?
Yeah, they should have done three.
Yeah, at least do three, so it feels like a round number. But
I thought they were going to do like Netflix or something.
Yeah. Do you think they offered all the studios a chance to buy it and only two of them did?
And one of them is the broadcast.
The people who broadcast the show.
So we've had no time to report, but that would be something that would be good to get a little intel on, because it was just weird and it seemed like too much and yet not enough. When Margot Robbie did the thing with the audience, while viewers enjoy at home, truly the audience burst out laughing. I mean, it was just, it was like, this is ridiculous. Yeah.
Like, what is the reason we couldn't see it in the theater? I don't know what a reason could be for that, because it's not like it's about rights or something when it's just for the live audience.
What did you guys see instead?
Like one of those real packages.
Yeah. Every commercial break, we saw kind of like interviews with the people who are nominated for an upcoming category, and like as movie nerds, that was fine, and but, you know, better than nothing. And it was something similar to that during those little trailers. So,
I think it's what you would have seen if you scanned your QR code, Richard and Katie. I think the same thing.
I'm so sorry, I didn't jump to my phone.
I wonder if anyone watching actually did scan the QR code.
I want to know the tally.
But isn't that because studies say young people are always on like two or three screens at a time. So maybe they were trying to cater to that. But
I mean, I've certainly been guilty of that myself, but like scanning a QR code just never feels like the most like natural movement. Wait, but speaking of film nerd parts, the part that I could really see on the air, and I don't know if it was as visible in the room, but during a couple of the technical categories, like you have Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors talking about cinematography and like a camera rolled out on stage. And then with costume design, they had some of the nominated costumes like on mannequins in the background. And it really reminded me of some of those old Oscar ceremonies we've talked about. It felt like some like old school glitz. I like that. It's like a little bit of cheese and some bits, but it was about the nominees themselves. It felt really tonally right.
Yeah. That was my favorite part of the whole show. It was really visible in the ceremony. And the whole time, you felt this really consistent reverence for craft and for how these things are made, and those very, very frequent reels of, you know, an Avatar clip and then the behind the scenes spliced next to it. And just like trying to give viewers at home who maybe don't know a sense of what went into these movies and why it is important that all of these categories are presented and actually given a moment.
I thought they did it during the actual broadcast. Yeah.
Yeah. On the air for people in the room. Like, I thought they did a very good job with that. I thought it was a very strong, implicit rebuke to what they did last year in more ways than one, you know, not just presenting them, but embracing what they are, not going too out there. And just trying to strip it down a little bit and show what the Oscars are supposed to be, and maybe wonder if that's enough, and maybe it is. Because I certainly think that, especially when you have big movies like that winning and you can appreciate what went into them, it's an effective way to tell that story.
They did a nice job of showing very brief clips of past winners when they were starting a category too, that I thought sort of made you remember what sort of, you know, impressive wins had happened before. And the way they honored the past, I think, was really appreciated by the room.
Yeah, Richard, as our, you know, dedicated correspondent to Oscars of the past, did you get some of that same satisfaction from this year's show?
Yeah, I think that they brought some of the sort of reverence back. And I know people roll their eyes at that. Oh, it's so self-important. But like, what is it supposed to be? You know, like this is, they're giving people gold trophies. Like that's the whole thing. And I think that in recent years, any attempts to make the Oscars hip and to be a little bit sort of sardonic and wry about like, oh, you know, isn't this silly? And I think, you know, I think even with Kimmel, like he didn't do that shtick that he's done in years past where he's sort of mocking the thing. And I mean, there was a little bit of it in his jokes, but like it felt more good natured than before. And I think that that might be the way to, with the combination of a movie like Everything Everywhere winning and the old school kind of Oscar theatrics, like maybe that's a way to sort of build a coalition of the older and the young in terms of being interested in this, in watching the ceremony, you know? So I think attempts to kind of yoke the current Oscars to the past are good. I think that they make sense given what the Oscars are supposed to be.
Yeah, David and Rebecca, I asked you guys early in the night because I felt like the monologue, Jimmy Kimmel's monologue, was fine. Like it landed some jokes and some not jokes as usual standard. But you guys said it went over really well in the room.
Yeah, yeah. It did. I thought it was a great, I mean, the women director joke, I think, was my favorite part. But I thought the whole thing played really well. The whole like, you know, these people in the audience will beat you up if you come up, and then like going to Michelle Yeoh. I mean, all the bits.
That was a great way to be like, hey, these people are in huge movies that you love. Yeah. Spider-Man's here.
I thought that was really smart. Yeah. Really smart. Too.
Yeah.
Smarter than the fan favorite moment, maybe.
Yes. There's a way to do it. To call them out without having this insane online poll. I think there was just a feeling of assurance. And there was a feeling of being in the hands of someone who, first of all, one thing he does as a host that is uniquely comforting is he's very much there for the people in the room and not just the broadcast. And so you have these, you know, mystery snack boxes under your seat that he has given you. You have more of a one-on-one feeling, more of a, yes, he is here for the people in this room. He is hosting a dinner, a show, and he is giving you the kind of comedy that reflects the people in the room. And I think that there's something that feels quite safe about that in a way that is appealing, as opposed to something that can make people feel awkward. Or it also helped that I thought it was, you know, pretty solid. It was very standard and very safe, but I thought it was a good Oscars monologue. And that's what everyone in that show wanted last night.
Yeah. Talking to people at the parties, it just felt like everyone just wanted a safe, smooth show that celebrated some movies and didn't have any drama attached to it. And that's okay to want that. And I think that's, they delivered that. So I think Jimmy was the perfect host for that reason.
I support Jimmy Kimmel, but I also did like the moment where Malala just like shut down his whatever. I don't remember what joke he set up for her, but she just like, I only talk about peace. Goodbye. You know, go for it. Yeah,
that bit was not great.
There was a little too much cocaine bear in the evening.
There was, though. I couldn't believe they brought it back. For Malala, no less.
I think that sort of idea that this is going to be safe and, what you know, compared to last year, whatever, like, I think that also was reflected in the winners. Like, I think that there was a, if now it's in the past, we can look at this year's Oscar season as, like, people wanted to feel good. And I think that's, I mean, obviously there are plenty of people who don't feel good about Fraser winning or The Whale winning anything, but, like, from the industry perspective, like that's a great happy story, as is Michelle Yeoh, as is Jamie Lee Curtis. Angela Bassett would have been a happy story too. Kiwi Kwan is a great story. And I think that it was just a sort, there was a sense that a lot of stories were being voted for almost as much as the movies themselves were, or the performances themselves were. And, you know, I could kind of grumble about that from a, you know, a sort of like purist standpoint, but like they gave themselves the evening they wanted, kind of top to bottom. And I can't blame them for that.
Yeah, I said that, I think, last night on the live stream at our party, but those, I don't remember, you were all four winners were sort of comeback stories where these are people who either left the industry or the industry abandoned them, or they've just been completely underestimated, you know, during their career. And every one of those awards was like such a feel-good moment. So I think that's a pretty significant note.
We did get a listener question already, and I apologize if I've not been able to look this up, asking when was the last time all four winners were first-time nominees? So we're going to have to look into that because I don't know. I imagine it's, I mean, it's probably more common than the 16 first-time nominees total than we had. But, you know, that energy was very palpable, I think.
Definitely. Even someone like Sarah Polley winning again.
I can't believe we haven't talked about Sarah Polley, David.
Oh, no. But it is a story vote. It is a campaign that was run beautifully. And that movie was very hard fought to get into this race. But I think people really fell in love with her and admired what she did, even as that movie struggled to find a wider audience.
And she's been in the industry since she was a child, you know? Like,
yep, exactly.
That's another thing. It's a dim echo of the Kiwi Kwan thing. Like, I think this was just a lot of, they circled the wagons around their people and said, young man, Austin Butler, you have to wait your turn. That's not where we're at this year. And, you know, I think that sentiment was on the wall at SAGs, and I should have listened to David and Rebecca in doing my predictions, but I thought they would go the other route.
We can make our mea culpas, Richard, that we were on the wrong side of the best actor predictions. It happens to the best of us. I mean, yeah, David, you were telling, you finally did tell me last night, like, yeah, I was confident about Brendan Fraser. You didn't tell me I was an idiot, but it was, you know, the subtext was clear. But yeah.
No. I had been so reluctant to go there, even though that's where my head was. And once I kind of finally settled on it after he won SAG, I did feel pretty good about that prediction, but I was also just talking about over the course of the evening, like once Elvis lost, it was just very clear that Brendan Fraser was win.
The makeup win was the tipping point, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Austin was not going to be the only win for that movie. That would have been really weird. So yeah, at a certain point it was like, this is definitely Brendan's to lose.
I do want to go back to Sarah Polley for a second. Rebecca, would you like to report David's reaction when Sarah Polley won?
Yeah. David's yelp out into the audience was, first of all, somehow before everyone else reacted. And so I was like, did they hear that on the broadcast? That was the loudest thing I've ever heard. It was a very sweet moment. And then at the party, Sarah Polley told us the story about how her husband fainted after she like hugged him and went on stage because he was just like so overwhelmed. So I'm surprised David didn't faint is what I'm saying. And
it provokes strong responses, Rebecca. Like I'm on the side of history here. And her husband's named David. So the Davids reacted in the room.
Yeah. Well, and her husband was at the party. He recovered in time to go celebrate, which I feel is an important update.
Yes. And she was telling everyone this story, so I don't think I'm sharing something.
In terms of my reaction, just to sort of put in some context, it's been no secret that this movie's been a passion project of mine this season. But the way the night was going, it felt like All Quiet on the Western Front was going to win that category. And I'd already resigned myself to predicting that. So mm-hmm. I was just like, it's not winning. I think I literally turned to Rebecca 30 minutes before and I was like, it's not happening. And then the fact that Florence Pugh said Women Talking, number one, yes, very exciting moment for me and for Sarah Polley, not just for me. But also it was, you know, not to say I was actively rooting against All Quiet on the Western Front, but you know, you want that Everything Everywhere moment. That's where we were there for. And to me, that moment also solidified that this was not going to be the All Quiet upset. Because if it can't beat Women Talking in adapted screenplay, it's not winning Best Picture. So it was a layered shriek in some.
Well, it occurs to me that our two big hope predictions, that like the two big things we predicted we didn't know if they would come true, were Women Talking and Michelle Yeoh, and they both happened. Like, that's a lovely thing. The shorts, it didn't work out so well, unfortunately. Yeah.
We bombed in the shorts, guys.
We were 0-3, right? Yeah.
Yes.
I think we were 0-3. At least we were all in it together. And like some of us, we don't have to gloat over the other ones. Yeah. Well, you know, so some worthy winners in there, but I would have liked to see, you know, our year of dicks. We love you still.
I think there was one worthy winner in there. Not to be nasty, but I personally think they picked the worst movie in two of the three of those categories.
Yeah.
Wow. Better like next year to all of us.
I tweeted about the boy, the fox, the mole, whatever the hell that thing. And that tweet went like viral. And all of these people were like, oh my God, people were laughing at the bad dialogue when I went to go see the shorts in the theater. Like, apparently there is a wave of dislike for that movie that I was previously unaware of.
Yeah, and I don't feel bad about trashing it because the campaign for that was very, very loud. And so Apple got it. Not, you know, they fought for it, but it's a bad movie. It's a bad movie.
It's interesting because I think I felt like so confident in our choices because we had watched them all. We had discussed them all. I was like, that feels like a lot more than maybe a lot of voters have done. But I think next year I want to do a little more digging into the politics behind them because I think those races are probably a little more political than I anticipate every year.
I think better finance, too, is the secret that we're learning behind that.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, we should end the Oscars point of our discussion so we can get to the Vanity Fair party. I mean, the Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, cruise through the end. I love Dan Kwan talking about his mom. Any other highlights from the final Best Picture moment?
I think it was really cool how many of them talked about their moms, especially their immigrant mothers. I mean, obviously that's the theme of that film, but as a child of an immigrant mother, like I've never had an experience where I got to see an Asian face talk about that on screen. And the weight of your mom's expectations can weigh on you. Obviously, Michelle has brought that up a lot. It just like to see that come alive was really, really special. The producer, Jonathan Wong, also mentioned his immigrant parents as well. So it just feels like, I've said this before, but you know, a lot of the people involved with that film are carrying sort of the, you know, the sacrifices of their own parents, which is a lot of people's story in this country as well, not just Asian people, but you could really feel it, I think, when they were accepting that win. I do feel like, because I think when we look at this year and last year with Coda, it just proves that it doesn't matter when a film premieres. Like, we've always assumed it's the fall premiere films that will have the easiest journey, but you know, we're looking at a South by film and a Sundance film winning. So it's interesting how we have to kind of, I think, watch throughout the year more than we used to.
Yeah. To tag onto that, I do think we can zoom out a little bit and just point out the weirdness of the fact that the Above the Line Oscar winners for 2023 are Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Whale, and Women Talking, and that's it. Mm. I mean, that is weird. You told me that 6 months ago, I would have been like, you are a fucking idiot. But that's where they went. I mean, it's a strange but kind of beautiful year.
Okay, we'll be right back to talk about the Vanity Fair party after this break. There's lots more to come.
We're here in Los Angeles at the Vanity Fair Oscars party. It's so busy.
Honestly, this party's really fun because you get to see your... I'm itching. Itch
oh,
my
sorry,
back.
Yeah, of course. Itch over here?
Back. Yeah, right there. Right there. Yeah. No, up, in.
I want to get to the dance floor as soon as possible. Will there be one in there?
Absolutely. There's going to be a dance floor. It's going to be lit up, I think. I've never been to this party before.
Really?
Have you? No, that was a lie. I don't know. I've never been in there. Apparently, maybe you know this already, but you can jump the queue if you come and talk to me. So I feel like that's a pretty good way of doing things. Okay. Are you hungry? Oh, brilliant. Well, I was going to ask you what your In-N-Out burger order was because I'm taking orders.
You know what, though? I've never had a hamburger in my life.
What?
Huh?
Are you veggie?
No.
Oh, what do you mean?
I eat other things. I've just never had a hamburger.
How is that possible?
Bye-bye.
Gigi, what are you excited about tonight besides the burger?
Besides In-N-Out? Well, that was my answer, so you took it away. I'm just excited for... to be here, you know, for a night that I have nothing to do with.
I'm going to do that tonight.
Yeah.
I'm going to dance on a table tonight.
Have you ever been...
Are the tables on there?
I don't know. I've never been. I'll get a table for you. Excuse me? Can we please
get a table
for Paul Mescal to dance
pronto.
On?
Pronto.
Pronto. Stat.
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 I'm really good at presenting, so you know.
I want to look at the audience, right? But you've got to read. So there's a bit of this and a bit of this, a bit of this, a bit of this.
You want to look down and say, hey, Michelle, yo.
Yeah,
you
what's good?
No, I can't actually leave now, but I would love to leave and go to the party with you.
Come on,
Shall
then.
Shall we just do it?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Okay, bye, guys. I'm going off with Pedro.
So what you just heard were the highlights from our two live streams from the Vanity Fair Oscar party last night. I was on hosting the first hour with Mike Hogan, our colleague, and Franklin Leonard of The Blacklist and a VF contributor. And then the second hour was hosted on TikTok by Amelia de Moldenberg, the chicken shop date girl herself. It was kind of a blur for me, honestly. Like, if you guys tell me specific people I talk to, I might be able to remember it. Richard, we trust you as the fair arbiter. What did you witness from the Vanity Fair party that we can tell you about?
Well, you know, I watched some of the live stream. I looked at a lot of the photos of the Mark Seliger studio. You know, I read the party report from Nate Freeman, I believe.
So it seems like it was well attended and people were really enjoying themselves. But I'm curious from you folks who were there, like, was there a sort of belle of the ball, you know? Like, some, it feels like in the years I've gone, like, people are surrounding one person or movie or something. I'm assuming it would be Everything Everywhere, but who was getting the most attention from what you saw?
The non-winner duo that I saw get, like, swarmed the entire time was Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors, which I think you're talking about a film just that just, like, had a huge box office performance, and they're obviously, like, giant movie stars. And I think it's those moments of sort of watching huge stars interact with people you don't see, you know, just sort of like across mediums, or you've never seen them work on films together, but you see those like relationships and friendships that you have on screen. I thought was really special to watch at that party every year.
Yeah, I had the same experience. When I got there, the first person I walked by was Justin Bieber, who was wearing a blanket thing.
I think it was a quilt.
Look, I was cold sometimes. I admire it.
No judgment. No judgment. Just striking, you know? It's like, oh, I'm here. Hello, Vanity Fair. And near the end, it felt like Billie Eilish had a huge crowd around her and was kind of, you know, tightly packed in with like people like Tessa Thompson. And that was a fun sight. But it did feel like the Everything Everywhere, that train never quite came in. But Michelle Yeoh did have a great dancing moment on the dance floor. So we did have that.
Yeah, I was just going to say Michelle Yeoh was the obvious belle of the ball because she kind of came in, not with her Everything Everywhere crew. She was kind of on her own. And she, you know, what you're saying, Richard, kind of feel the gravitational pull of the room move towards someone. And I watched it happen with her. And we had hosted a party with the Everything Everywhere cast on Friday before the Oscars. And it was the same thing in a much smaller room.
We could not move, Katie.
We could not move, except somehow everyone moved toward Michelle Yeoh anyway, where she left a conga line at that party. really more at that Friday party than on Sunday, just because of how much I saw her. Like, she was just having a really good time. Like, someone who has been on this trail for so, so long, like, seemed to really be reveling in it and dancing and taking selfies. And I was really delighted to see her. That's kind of the moment where you feel like, ah, yes, the Oscars are over. These very worthy winners are getting to properly celebrate and then hopefully go home and rest.
And, you know, even the people who didn't win, like I saw a really nice photo from our party of Angela Bassett and Stephanie Hsu in a very tight, smiley embrace, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that the party can provide a really nice opportunity. Okay, you didn't win, but you can breathe now. It's over. You know, it's like getting voted off Survivor. You're like, I didn't win, but I get to go to, you know, Ponderosa and eat some food. And and I think that's great that people can kind of be like, you know what, we got this far. You know, only one of us was going to win, and now we can just kind of enjoy each other's company. And I think that's a really good reason to have a party.
Yeah. You did talk to Rian Johnson, Katie, on the live stream. And one of my favorite category to track through the month has been adapted screenplay. And I spent quite a bit of time with Kazuo Shiguro, as well as Bill Nye from Living. And it just felt like everyone there, that spirit carried through to the party in a really wonderful way. And they were the only two nominees from that movie, and their director Oliver Hermanis was there. And it was just, you know, they're at the Vanity Fair party. They're having a great time. And that's all you can ask for. They probably knew they were not going to win. And so this was the last hurrah, and they were very happy to have it.
Yeah, I talked to Ryan's wife, Karina Longworth, who's been on this podcast before a little bit afterwards, and she was kind of reflecting on how they learned from 2019 when Knives Out was nominated, like how to navigate this whole process a little bit more, which I think for people who are writers or work behind the scenes is still overwhelming, kind of no matter how many times you've done it. And last night, you really get a sense of people being like, this is the end. I'm going to push. I'm going to stay up later than I would have because, you know, this time next week, I'll be home on my couch. So that really adds to the celebratory feel that it's the very, very last gasp of something very long.
I did see Austin Butler holding an Oscar.
Oh, interesting.
And I had
alternate universe.
Multiple people described. I didn't see it, but multiple people described this site to me.
And I was like, "Whoa! Did I get confused? Am I in a different multiverse? What happened here?" And then I realized it was the Navalny team's Oscar. But it was weird to see him. Like, he was literally doing that thing when it's your first time holding, and you're like, "Oh, this is heavy," you know. And it was a weird sight to see at the party.
Around 1 or 2 a.m., the Oscar that went round the party's world, was the Avatar: Way of Water visual effects Oscar. Many people held that Oscar. Many people.
In our community, we call that a pass-around party Oscar.
I'm new to this, so I got to learn the lingo. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of groups of people who I saw, which is sometimes like people interacting with each other. Like, and this is not a group, but when I first walked into the party, the first person I laid eyes on was David Spade. And then the second was Nancy Pelosi. Like, they were not talking to each other. They were incredibly close together.
Well, they're doing a Tommy Boy reboot together.
Yeah.
So.
And then I saw Riz Ahmed, Jesse Buckley, and Malala deep in conversation, like really leaning in to talk to each other. And that felt really special to me, too.
That's lovely.
Was anyone a real dancer that you saw? Like, was anyone just like
Michelle.
Living on the dance floor? Michelle.
Yeah. I mean,
Michelle Yeoh is, the dance floor took a little bit long. It was an interesting night. I mean, from what I know of last year, which obviously very unusual case, it kind of peaked earlier. But this night, I mean, even we were, Katie and I were there until closing, and it was pretty lively until they turned down the music, and the dance floor was probably near its most crowded at that point. It was strangely drawn out in a way that I appreciated because I didn't feel burned out by that point because everyone was having a good time.
Now, what time was that? Was that 4 a.m.?
It was about 2:30. It was very reasonable, okay. Richard. We're professionals.
Okay.
I feel like I usually, after, you know, we finish this recording, I go through and look at the photos from inside. I'm like, oh, my God, I was at this one place, and that was happening over there. Like, you kind of piece together the night via these beautiful photographs by Justin Bishop and other photographers inside the party. So there's kind of a nice way to relive it, even for those of us who were actually in there.
That's the thing with that party is, like, I wish I could be in every room at this everywhere at the same time. Everywhere all at once at the same time, because there's always something cool going on in a different room. And, like, we'll meet up and you guys will tell me about something that was in one room. And I'll see, like, it's just there's moments all the time happening in that room. It's really special.
Yeah, Richard, I texted you this. I should have saved it for being on the air, but just pretend you're shocked all over again. But I was trying to get through a door and I was stopped because Sharon Stone, our Oscars queen herself, in this chartreuse cape train situation, was talking to Brendan Fraser, and they were in this hallway, and Brendan Fraser's girlfriend had this big dress also, so there was just no way to get past them. So I was just watching, like, Brendan Fraser kiss Sharon Stone's hand and she was congratulating him, and it just felt like the only way that these Oscars could have gone. I missed you in that moment, Richard.
I'm so sad I missed that, but I'm just glad that Sharon is carrying the torch, you know. And she was in a commercial that aired during the broadcast, so I can include her in my recap in 20 years, which, as a Frank McCormick on Twitter pointed out to me, and I was very, very happy about that.
Well, in terms of revisiting the night, you can also rewatch the live stream that I was on, which I guess I'll have to do so I can piece together all my memories of it. But I do want to flag the part where we were talking to Cheryl Lee Ralph, speaking of sung acceptance speeches. She had this kind of like peacock eyeshadow that matched her earrings that you really need to just see to imagine. And then, you know, we're being told to kind of wrap it up with Cheryl Lee Ralph because Gigi Hadid is waiting to talk to us, and they don't want her to have to wait around so long she doesn't come on the live stream. And so, but it's really hard to wrap up with Cheryl Lee Ralph. Like, she wants to talk. She's lovely to talk to. You want to talk to her all night. And so finally, Gigi Hadid just kind of like pops onto the live stream, and like they'd never met before, but she was so excited to meet Cheryl Lee Ralph, as most people would be. But that kind of collision between people from totally different worlds, just full of admiration for each other.
Amazing.
That was fun to watch firsthand. So everyone should go catch up with that.
Yeah, the world's colliding thing at that party is, I remember my first one, I looked and Amy Poehler and Tina Fey were talking to Anita Hill. And I was like, oh, sure, okay.
Of course.
Why only at this party would that happen. And then I turned to my left and Barbara Streisand and Oprah were deep in conversation. And I was like, that makes a little more sense, but still.
Yeah, I saw Jeff Bezos with his girlfriend, Lauren Sanchez, for a while, like meeting a lot of different people. But Jeff Bezos was not like really the main draw. Like, there were clusters of people in other areas that were like, people who are like, yeah, Bezos, but like Billie Eilish is over here. Like that, for him not to be the most interesting person in the room, that is how you know it's a good party. Well, that does it for our bleary, not up to our 100% standards audio post-Oscar episode. We'll be back to normal next week, we promise. We're going to take the rest of this week off. Thank goodness there is no emergency to deal with post-Oscars. One of us is getting on an international flight today, so we'll not be around for slap-level reporting. I think we're all relieved by that. And then we'll be back next week, like true maniacs, with our 2024 Oscars predictions, which, David, I'm going to blow up your spot. As we were leaving the party last night, some of our colleagues were like, so who's going to win next year? And you had an answer ready.
I didn't have an answer, but like truly, actually, I'm going to go back to an earlier point of Richard's, because in my head, the star of the party was Greta Lee, because I had seen Past Lives fairly recently, and I was truly more starstruck seeing her than probably anybody in that room, because the movie is extraordinary, and I think it will be a big contender.
I think there were a couple people at that party that we were like, we'll see you next year.
Yeah. Well, that's how Nate's party report ends. He saw Alden Ehrenreich and was thinking about Fair Play at Sundance. So I was like, okay, let the games begin. But also,
and by the way, Past Lives is an A24 movie. Just saying.
Wow, here we go. It's already happening. So for more of that, tune in next week. We'll have our friend Joe Reed back as usual. We'll revisit last year's predictions, where I'm pretty sure no one ever mentioned the phrase everything everywhere all at once. So, you know, we get another year of guessing ahead of us. In the meantime, thank you guys. Thank you, Richard and Rebecca and David. It's been such a great season. I feel like we need to give our acceptance speech, even though we'll be recording this podcast next week. I'm feeling good. You guys feeling good? I feel like we've really left the season on a high note.
Yeah. I feel really good.
It's a great wrap up. It was a great, great year. And like, I thought our listeners asked so many great questions or taught us things all seasons, even pronouncing people's names. And I feel like we learned a lot this year.
It's nice to be out in the world and hear from people who are listening, because I feel like we had a lot of that this year, which was nice. And it made the season more exciting, too, because it was a little topsy-turvy for a while there.
We reached a milestone, folks. My parents listened to our Oscar predictions episode together. That, in my knowledge, has never happened before. So I think we've really we've passed through some sort of membrane into the broader consciousness.
Major. That's major.
And now we will never forget how to pronounce Barry Keoghan's name, because when you have to say people's names on the air, you learn how to get it right. Not that we'll not continue to get things wrong in the future, but many things that we learned this season. Well, that does it for the episode. Find everything on VanityFair.com, from the party, from the Oscars, the live streams, Richard's review of the show. There's so much to dig into. I'm going to be reading all of it. This show is on Twitter at VF Awards Insider. That's on Instagram as well. And we're on Twitter on our own. I'm at Katie Rich, and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of a post-Oscar hangover goes to Rebecca Ford.
Am I in a different multiverse?
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.